John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And did you ever win a prize in a contest you never entered? Awesome. Well, it's the unfortunate experience for a large number of people on the Obama administration's terrorist watch list, on the list without any known affiliation with terrorist groups. So you ask, how did they get on the list in the first place? How did they win the prize? We'll solve that mystery, or try to anyway, in a moment. A grim look at the front lines of the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, and a woman who grew up in the featureless landscape of Nebraska is pushing out the horizon of feminism. Basically, folks, there's your life before you knew who Roxane Gay was, and then after. Today, folks, is the first day of the rest of your life. Stay tuned. We begin with those watchmen at the White House and the watchman in chief.
The bottom line is that people around the world, regardless of their nationality, should know that the United States is not spying on ordinary people who don't threaten our national security.
Sure, you say that, Mr. President, back in January, but the latest data published by Glenn Greenwald's The Intercept claims the findings include a watch list of 680,000 men and women, many from the U.S., from Houston, New York, Dearborn, alongside a 500,000 facial images and tens of thousands of iris scans. And 40% of those being monitored have no recognized terrorist group affiliation, according to the Intercept report. Joining me now is David Gomez, former senior assistant special agent in charge of the Seattle FBI office. Welcome, David.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
So what do you make of the breakdown of this watch list and its apparent proliferation of false positives?
Well, as I read the article that was written by Jeremy Scahill, whom I've known for a number of years, I think that it's a bit misleading in the sense that people don't understand that this is a worldwide list and the proliferation of numbers is based on a worldwide aggregation of people onto the list as opposed to just U.S. citizens, people from Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia. Those portions of the list have expanded because the government made an effort to identify members of these terrorist organizations and place them on the watch list, first of all, and then the no-fly list later on. But in terms of in the U.S., it's harder to get on the list, and it's probably easier to get off in these days because the FBI, at least in the United States, is making a concerted effort to review those cases and either modify them or delete them if they're not appropriate.
Look, David Gomez, I'm not a lawyer, but you know what you've just said falls a little bit short of what I would consider due process, you know?
Well, for a United States citizen, due process can take place in a court of law. I mean, you can certainly sue the FBI to remove you from the list to say that you have no affiliation. FBI headquarters maintains a system where you can appeal your placement on the list. But again, the FBI is running cases. It's not like the general list that people worldwide are being placed on the list and used for screening purposes, selective purposes, or no-fly purposes. In the FBI, if your name is on that list, it's because we have either an assessment or an investigation open against you. Whether that's appropriate or not is something that would be taken up by either the field office or headquarters when you make that appeal.
So the case of FBI names would relate to specific active cases. The broader list is just something of a database that the FBI would have access to.
Yeah, think of it as a giant research library for the United States intelligence community. A lot of the metrics that are on there are for the United States intelligence community and not just for the FBI. And I don't want to mislead anybody and say that everybody that is on that list has had an active case open against them.
I guess I'm concerned that, you know, to describe this database as kind of a Library of Congress for the security agencies, I don't know if it's as benign as, say, a voter registration list, as it can really cast completely innocent Americans into a identity that they have no way of escaping from.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. I mean, if you look at the numbers that were published in the article and you look at the actual numbers of U.S. citizens and U.S. persons on the list compared to the total numbers, the article seems to stress the total numbers of 47,000 people on a no-fly list, when in fact there's only about 1,000 United States persons on that list. That's quite a bit of difference. When they talk about how many people were from the FBI during 2012, 2013, were nominated, they have the number 7,500 people. But what they don't really kind of stress is that 2,800 of those people were deletions. The FBI is making a lot of effort to remove people from the list because it's a resource issue for the FBI. Former Director Mueller emphasized that no terrorism lead would go uncovered, and that has put a lot of pressure on counterterrorism units within the FBI to resolve these cases quickly. So when a person comes from another agency nominated to the list and it comes to the FBI because that person is a U.S. citizen or a U.S. person, the FBI has to make a concerted effort, and we're under time constrictions legally to get that case resolved, to either say, yes, this person has some relationship to terrorism and we need to open either a preliminary investigation or a full investigation based on our own acquisition of knowledge about that person, or close the case and remove them from the list.
You know, it looks from the, you know, frequency of names on the list that the government considers Dearborn, Michigan, with so many Arab Americans, to be some kind of center of suspicion. Is that appropriate?
Well, it is one of those things that's, you know, is entirely appropriate because that's a center of population for people from the Middle East or from the Afghan-Pakistan region. If you were running the same kind of database and you were looking at suspected narcotics dealers, I think you'd see a predominance of names from people from the American Southwest because it borders Mexico and Central America. It's a transition point. So the data itself can be misleading in the sense that it's not because we specifically targeted Arab Americans, but that is a concentration where people who might be on the list from the Middle East, from the Afghan-Pakistan region, have settled.
So the Dearborn numbers don't smack of profiling?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, the data leads you to a certain point. So if all those people suddenly move to Los Angeles, then you might say, well, why is Los Angeles such a big deal? You know, the people concentrate where the people concentrate. You know, the data follows them. We don't try to follow, influence the data.
In the investigations after 9/11, the notion was that data existed within the government that wasn't shared that could have stopped the terrorists at 9/11 because of watch lists that, you know, certain agencies didn't have access to. Would you say that this article is describing a fix to that system or a monster that's been created that maybe we should get the genie back into the bottle here?
I think the author's point of view is that it's a genie that has escaped the bottle, and it's a problem that needs to be fixed. I'm not sure I agree with that idea in its totality. You know, for American citizens, there has to be a standard. For American and U.S. persons, which is a kind of a subcategory of United States citizens, but for any person legally here in the United States, there has to be a standard by which we meet. And that standard, from my perspective, needs to be a little higher than reasonable suspicion. It causes an awful lot of work for U.S. law enforcement.
David Gomez is a former senior FBI special agent. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The Ebola outbreak in West Africa has put international airlines on notice that they could be carriers of something other than tourists right now. British Airways suspended flights to Sierra Leone and Liberia yesterday, and leaders from the region have new concerns about their neighbors.
With intercontinental flights, all you need is a flight to the U.S. or to Europe so that you have a world crisis, a total crisis.
That's Senegalese President Macky Sall speaking through an interpreter at the U.S. African Leaders Summit in Washington, D.C. The summit has been distracted by the Ebola crisis, which, while contained for the moment in Liberia and Sierra Leone, as far as health officials can tell, it may be about to break out of its ground zero. The Sierra Leone government announced it will deploy 750 soldiers throughout the country to enforce the isolation of infected patients. There are more than 1,600 reported cases in the infected area. Richard Preston, writer for The New Yorker and author of the 90s bestseller The Hot Zone, has been inquiring about the conditions in the worst affected clinics. And what he's hearing brings to mind images we haven't seen since the plague in the 14th century.
There have been reports of dead bodies being abandoned in the streets of the city of Monrovia, the capital of Liberia. In Monrovia, the hospitals now are jammed with Ebola patients, and they are turning away all new patients, including people who may have Ebola already, and even women in childbirth. So the people who are sick are actually leaving the city. They're going out into the countryside in search of faith healers and magic, since the medical care system is in, you know, what appears to be a state of collapse. You know, in a medical sense, this is a war zone. The doctors and nurses are taking casualties. They are dying. The ones on the front lines are getting Ebola virus. They're working in clinics in absolutely horrifying conditions. I mean, the descriptions that I'm hearing are just unspeakable. Imagine a clinic in, let's say, a rural setting in Africa where you have this makeshift building. You have walls are made of plastic film for biocontainment. And then inside there, you have 30 people with Ebola virus on little cots jammed together, and one doctor in a space suit, in a biohazard suit, and one nurse in a space suit. And then patients are falling out of bed, they become disoriented, and they land on the floor. And the floor, I hate to say it, is covered with absolutely every substance that can come out of the human body.
I mean, every bodily fluid. I mean, it's basically a swill on the floor, and that is how Ebola is transmitted, bodily fluids.
Yes, and you can't get full protection in an environment that is that contaminated with Ebola virus. All it takes is just a few particles in your bloodstream, and you could be a goner. So, for example, it's thought that one way that Ebola gets into the human body is through the eyelids of the eyes. If you get a little bit of contamination or virus on your fingertips, and then you rub your eyelid, the virus can pass directly into the tissues, the moist tissues of the eyelid, and then from there enter your bloodstream. So it's just awfully hard for the even experienced hardcore professionals who have dealt with Ebola virus for years to stay safe.
What do epidemiologists say about what's happened? Is this a cycle because Ebola is native to this part of the world, or is this a jump on some level, some fundamentally new sort of move, domain for the Ebola virus?
Well, you know, Ebola virus right now is pulling some big surprises. First of all, this is the largest number of cases by far that have ever been seen in an outbreak. Second, the virus is now out of control. The doctors have lost contact with the cases, with the people who have Ebola virus. And finally, we've never seen Ebola virus in cities before, where it has the potential perhaps to do major damage. I think one great concern is what happens if Ebola virus gets into one of the really big cities in Africa, such as Lagos, the capital of Nigeria. So there is potential here for the outbreak to continue. And one of the things that I've been asking about and thinking about is Ebola virus actually in the process of making a permanent jump into the human species? You know, before there have been these outbreaks and then it dies down. But it's the desire of a virus, if you can speak of that, to become immortal. And a virus can immortalize itself by entering the human species and then just continuing a permanent chain of human-to-human transmission on and on ad infinitum. The doctors are saying that they doubt that could happen. But, you know, you think about poliovirus. Polio, there's a great vaccine for it. And even so, polio has not been eradicated. So could the same thing happen with Ebola? My best guess right now is that the doctors are going to beat this thing back. But it's going to be a long, bloody conflict. It's going to extend for months and maybe longer than that.
are they going to beat it back by using procedures that are already established in terms of dealing with something like this? Or is this something they're going to be basically writing as they go along? We're in a new territory.
That's a great question, and I'm really wondering it myself. I think that they're going to gain experience, and I think that they're going to try everything. And so often in major outbreaks of disease, and this happened in the old days when smallpox was still circulating on the planet, the epidemiologists tried various different methods and strategies for encircling smallpox virus, getting it under control, and then putting out a fire, basically. So, it's very possible that the epidemiologists, the doctors, are going to be trying new things. But I think it always boils down to the classic shoe leather techniques that epidemiologists have been using for more than a century. And that is identify who is sick, figure out how it's being transmitted and where it's going, know the enemy, and then isolate the people who are sick. It doesn't require high tech. It requires lots of field workers, people on the ground. But right now, there just simply aren't enough doctors. The doctors are stretched paper thin. And as I said, some of them are dying.
Richard Preston is the author of The Hot Zone and a writer for The New Yorker. Thanks so much.
Good to be with you, John.
Later this hour, as Sierra Leone confronts the Ebola outbreak, a former boy soldier shares the story of his country's and his violent past.
The powerlessness comes in the fact that you don't own your life. The commanders and circumstances own your life. The next minute you could die. You know, you lose any sense of thinking for future. You think, can I live to see the next minute? And if that's possible, can I live? So that's pretty much powerlessness in a way.
Author Ishmael Bea, later this hour. Stay with us.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo. Simplifying home theater setup with a single device that delivers all cable TV, on demand, and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. More at TiVo.com.
For you lovers of the game of darts, they hit a real bullseye today with the Rosetta Space Probe. The European Space Agency has made history by maneuvering a spacecraft alongside a speeding comet to begin mapping its surface in detail after a 10-year chase. 5 times around the sun and 4 billion miles. Matt Taylor has been watching the data stream into the European Space Agency Mission Control and is very proud of his team's parallel parking job.
This has been one of the significant challenges and reasons why we're doing Rosetta in the first place is to rendezvous with the comet, and we've successfully done that today. It's put us in the same orbit as the comet around the sun, and that allows us to continue to ride alongside it and watch it as it develops activity as it approaches the sun.
And for 10 years, you've been in this chase, and now you're in striking distance.
Yeah, this is it. It's a culmination of decades of people's work. I'm a recent latecomer to the mission. There are people here that have been working for, as I say, decades, most of their life. And the excitement is unbelievable. Every time we see something new with this comet, it brings in a new picture, some new data. It's just fascinating. It's an excellent job that I've got.
And, you know, it's kind of like, being at the track, watching a horse just sort of gain on the leader.
It's a little bit like that, yeah. But the thing is that it seems that the leader's changing its shape every time we look at it. It's a bit like looking at a developing photograph way back in the day. You don't see that anymore. But every time we are at a certain distance, we've taken images and readings from the comet, it's looked in a particular way. And now we're getting this close. We're really getting the real features of this beast. And it's... it seems to be a combination of all the comets that we've ever been to, so that's fascinating. I think we did a really good job at choosing this one.
And is this water vapor? Is this methane? Is this a rock? What is this here?
Well, this is what we aim to find out. We think there's a mixture of dust and many different ices and also some organics as well. And this is the fundamental thing. This stuff has been out there on the outskirts of the solar system, frozen in place from the very early stages of the solar system. So studying these things gives us a little time window back into the past to see what happened when all of this formed.
And you're going to land on this thing. I mean, I would think that's like kind of like putting a Volkswagen down on a surfboard.
Well, it's going to be an interesting feat. If we consider our estimates at the moment, we consider that the gravity on the surface of the comet is around about 10 millionths of the gravity that you're experiencing now on the Earth. So we don't want to have this lander bounce off, so it's going to be deployed, gradually descend towards the comet, and then screw itself in with its feet and then fire 2 harpoons to just doubly make sure that it doesn't bounce off the surface.
And will Rosetta still be functioning when it comes around the other side of the sun? Is it short-lived, or will it be basically attached to the comet like a GoPro camera?
Well, it's important to note that the Rosetta is the main orbiter. So we have an orbiter with about 11 instruments on it. Philae Lander, that we'll deploy in November, has another 10 instruments. We'll deploy that in November, and we hope that will last as long as possible. It's dependent on the activity of the comet and also being able to recharge its batteries. Rosetta will continue to orbit around the comet once we've deployed the lander, really monitoring this chain from this reasonably inert object that we see now to something that's firing off, you know, hundreds of pounds of kilos of matter, of dust and gas, as it reaches through its closest approach to the sun next year, and as you're indicating, as it starts to go away from the sun as well, and we start to see that activity die down. So, yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see this ringside sea.
That's fantastic. Matt Taylor, I suspect your wife has to kind of calm you down at night, otherwise you stay up all night talking about this thing.
She does, yeah. But the important thing is that I'm excited enough, and one of the major successes for this for me is that my kids are interested in it, and my son now wants to be a scientist. So that's what Rosetta's done for me personally, that now my son finally thinks his dad's cool.
Matt Taylor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Matt Taylor is a project scientist for the Rosetta Project at the European Space Agency, catching up with Comet 67P.
One hand on this wily comet. Take a drink just to give me some weight. Some Uberman I'd make a belly.
America's coasts churn out conformist pop culture and trends and orthodoxies and political players. But out in the wide open spaces, where the pickup trucks have gun racks and the speed bump is the highest elevation for hundreds of miles, the world looks different.
So we're standing on her front lawn, just a twirling her baton.
That's right, straight out of Nebraska, far from the worlds of Gloria Steinem, Oprah, and Lena Dunham, and the feminist rulemakers of the East and West Coasts, Roxane Gay has arrived. This fiction writer and essayist is a bad feminist. That title of her latest book is an example of her attitude and growing body of work. She's got a fresh view of feminism, goes beyond carping about Beyoncé's wealth and questions of name-changing, and whether you might have gender-offensive song lyrics on your playlist. Being from Nebraska, Roxane Gay knows a thing or two about football, she says, and doing things her own way.
Because I'm in the Midwest, I've always had, I think, a different experience with race and with feminism and the kinds of social issues that really drive our culture. I've been able to observe how they work in the cities because I do travel a lot. But then I also get to see how I experience these issues in middle America, where, quite frankly, the majority of people actually live. And being in the Midwest, I think, has really helped shape my perspective and helped me to see some of the complexities of what it means to be anyone, really.
Who do you think you're connecting to right now? All of a sudden, I mean, you've been around for a long time, but you know, it's like an overnight sensation, right?
Yeah, it's been overwhelming. But I think I'm connecting to women who have historically not felt like they could claim feminism, who have felt the way I often have, that feminism is a bad word and that it's not a compliment when you've been called a feminist. I think creating a space for feminism to be less rigid and more open to the actual lived experiences of women.
You know, bell hooks, a feminist who calls herself a feminist, a very outspoken feminist on this program, when I asked her, you know, what's feminism about in this day and age, she said feminism is about fighting the patriarchy. And if you're not doing that, you're doing little more than just a kind of feel-good Oprah thing.
Mm-hmm.
Very provocative. What do you think of that?
Mm-hmm. I think that she's brilliant. And I think that she's a warrior. And I think she's very provocative. And I think we need provocation. And I don't think that saying feminism can be flawed is being Oprah, let's just embrace everything. And I think people just want to interpret it that way because they don't want to think hard. What does it mean to fight the patriarchy? I think we just say that, and then there are a few examples of what fighting the patriarchy actually looks like. And so I think that's a nice soundbite, but we have to, and this is not about hooks, it's just in general, because she has fought the patriarchy and has done so gallantly for years. But in general, when we say those kinds of things, I think we have to follow it up with specifics, like what can we actually do? What does it mean to fight the patriarchy, and where are we sort of directing our energies?
In the 20th century, feminism and women's rights were really about charting progress. In your writing, I get a sense that it's not so much about some objective sense of progress. It's a more inward kind of thing.
Definitely, because I think a lot of the change that we're going to need to see in our culture does come from within. I think we all have to take a hard look at ourselves and what we do and what we think and why we think in order to really force change in these huge institutions that control us and that shape our world. It starts with us. It really does. And then we continue to look more and more outward to create more change.
Why did you take up the subject of Chris Brown? Why even go near that?
Oh, because he's deeply influential to young women. And there were a lot of young women who were taking to social media saying that they were so enamored by him that they were willing to take a punch. That's heartbreaking. How can I not say something? He's a young man, and I think he's a troubled young man, and I understand why he's troubled, but that's an explanation and not an excuse. And so I was absolutely going to try and raise awareness about why those women should want better for themselves and why we should think critically about Chris Brown, about Sean Penn, about Roman Polanski, about Woody Allen, about all of these famous men who are allowed to get away with very bad things.
What do you make of this football player, Rice, who got a two-game suspension? I mean, the men on sports radio went wild over this, but I'm wondering what your thoughts are.
I thought the Ray Rice situation was ridiculous. Two-game suspension is nothing. And so I struggled with that. I think it's a shame. But I think that Ray Rice is very well positioned and has been well positioned for quite some time. He's part of a very successful system. The NFL is, I think, the only sports league where every team is profitable. And so it's in their best interest to continue to enable this kind of behavior. And so I don't really feel any pity for Ray Rice. Plenty of people get by without millions of dollars. I do feel empathy for his wife.
Right.
And I also, I think that he clearly needs help too. And so I think it's very hard to critique a marriage from the outside. We don't know what's going on in that marriage, but I'm not crying for Ray Rice.
Bad feminist. You love that term?
I do. It started out as a kind of a joke, a tongue-in-cheek thing, but it's kind of taken on a life of its own, and I'm happy with it.
Is this bad means good or just literally bad?
It depends on who you ask.
So your sequel is Sick Feminist, right?
Absolutely. Just Deviant Feminist. Bad.
Uh-oh. Here we go.
Oh, yeah.
Family show out the window.
It's a bad feminist is just an honest, like I'm honest about my contradictions and my inconsistencies and that I'm not, always on the right side of every issue, but I care and I'm willing to stand up and say, yes, I am a feminist. And yes, these issues matter. And I'm also willing to look at the range of people who should be served by feminism, which is not just middle-class white women or wealthy white women. It's women of color, it's transgender women, it's working class women, it's queer women. And so, yeah, I'm a bad feminist and pretty proud of it.
Roxane Gay, writer and author of Bad Feminist. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Coming off this feminism discussion, what ism bugs you? Republicanism comes to us from Hudson, Massachusetts. Liberalism, Ellsworth, Wisconsin. From the Bronx, heterosexism. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number, and there's much more at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening, especially to our new listeners today. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. Learn more at TiVo.com.